Hedrick Smith, a pleasure. Good morning.
My pleasure too, Melissa. Good to be with you.
And you'll be speaking tomorrow night at Flagler College. You'll also be meeting with students this week as
I'm really looking forward to it. I think that as a reporter, I learned a lot in doing the research for this book, Who Stole the American Dream? And I think there's a lot of American history that people don't get today. The inequalities we see in the income, the minimum wage, the 401k plans, a lot of things we take for granted didn't exist 30 years ago. And the middle class in America was better off because of it. A middle class in America in the 30 years after World War II actually shared in the prosperity and the growth of this country much better than it does today. So things have changed. And when I started working on this book back in 2009, my question was, how did we get to where we are? And what was it like before? So I'm really trying to get at the roots of things. What made for a good, solid, widely shared prosperity, and what has taken that away? Government policies, private sector strategies, what caused it?
And there were a number of policy changes that you write were made when the American public wasn't looking, wasn't really paying attention.
Yeah. Not only the public. I mean, we in the media. I mean, I was running the New York Times Washington Bureau in the late 1970s, and I think in the early 1980s, and I think like a lot of people, I thought the changes really started under Ronald Reagan when he became president. But in fact, they really started when the Democrats were running Congress and Jimmy Carter was in the White House. There were changes in tax policy. There were changes in wage policy. There were changes in government regulation. There were changes. The 401k, for example, was born in 1978, and it was never intended as a national retirement plan. It was actually a tax shelter for executives of Kodak and Xerox and a bunch of New York banks for their profit-sharing bonuses at the end of the year. It didn't affect ordinary workers. It didn't affect salaries. But people saw it as a great way to push the mutual fund industry saw it as a great way to push a kind of investing which would profit them enormously. And it got built into something that has really not worked very well for the middle class, but it's been enormously profitable for the banks and the mutual funds.
Sure.
And the bite they're taking out of people's savings, people are not aware of. I talked with Jack Boyle, the head of Vanguard, and he told me about it. The numbers are in the book. They're just staggering. I mean, the mutual funds actually wind up by taking more than half of your gains through their fees, and you are not even aware of it.
Yeah, people don't even realize it. But there are so many factors at work that people don't realize are affecting their ability to live well, share, as you say, the nation's prosperity, and retire with dignity.
Right. Well, what's interesting to me was I had not really realized it until I went back and thought about it. The prosperity of the American middle class really depended on the political activity, the activism, grassroots civic action by ordinary citizens, the civil rights movement, the women's movement. Back in the 1960s, women were making 41 cents on the dollar compared to men. Today, it's 77 cents, so we're not all the way there, but it's a lot better. That happened because of pressure that women put on both government policy, and you saw legislation passed in the early 1960s to move towards more equal pay, and the pressure they put on the economy. The consumer movement, which pushed for better labeling, safer cars, the kind of stuff you see now when you turn the suntan lotion over or the shampoo or whatever you're buying in a grocery store or a drugstore. That didn't exist back in the 1960s and 70s. People in the consumer movement says we want better protection. We want to be safer with the food we eat, with the drugs we buy, with the cars we buy. I mean, look, today we have GM, Toyota paying big fines because of defects in the cars. Well, Ralph Nader was talking about that in the 60s. That led to the consumer movement. Labor movement was stronger then. Better bargaining for wages. People had lifetime pensions. People had better health benefits before. So there was a pressure the middle class was putting on the system. That changed starting in the late 70s. The middle class sort of became less politically active. The financial elite, the big businesses became more powerful in Washington. They used to be roughly equal spending on lobbying and on political campaigns by labor and by business. Not so today. Business outspends labor 60-1 in Washington.
Sure.
And consumers. Outspends consumers 100-1.
So then what are your thoughts about the recent movement and discussion about this issue of income inequality in this country? Do you foresee that translating into actual policy changes at some point?
Well, there actually have been a couple of policy changes. First of all, let's understand, income inequality is indisputable. Citigroup, as well as liberal economists, said we have the greatest inequality since 16th century Spain in America today. That's 500 years. Greatest of any economic power in 500 years. That's staggering. Secondly, you have good economists saying that it's slowing economic growth, that the best economic growth we get as a country, everybody benefits when you have less income inequality. You look back in that earlier period as the salary levels at the top and the bottom and the middle were closer together, people at the middle and the bottom spend all their money. That's what drives the economy. When the money goes more to the people at the top, they save a lot. They buy luxury homes, they buy luxury yachts, but they also invest in stocks and businesses and so forth, and they don't spend the money. So, yeah, I mean, it's a huge issue. Now, the policies that have already begun to take place is, believe it or not, in the Affordable Care Act, there's actually income inequality addressed. There are fees and taxes imposed on the wealthy there that help slow down the income inequality. Okay, and then the tax increase was passed at the end of last year. That also increased the taxes, not much, but a little bit.
Aren't those just kind of nibbling around the edges though?
Sure, they are nibbling, but that's how it starts. I mean, you start with nibbling. I mean, we need to raise the minimum wage to help the people at the bottom. We need to change retirement benefits for people. We need to fix the corporate tax system so corporations can't move jobs and profits overseas and escape taxes.
Let me ask you, though, how does this country wrap its arms around the issue of retirement benefits? I mean, for example, here in this city right now, they are at an impasse as to how to deal with their massive unfunded pension liability. And for most people, pensions don't even exist anymore, and we can't even honor the ones that still do exist. So what is the solution, since 401ks have been, at best, a very imperfect structure? How can the nation figure this out as people continue to live longer and longer?
Yeah, well, that's a critical problem. First of all, let's understand that 401ks have not been imperfect at best. They have been a disaster. The median 401k balance in America today is under $20,000.
Right.
Okay? The median 401k balance in people in their 60s and who are getting ready to retire is about $85,000 or maybe $90,000. That's nowhere near what people need.
People need millions of dollars.
Well, no, people need... If you make $50,000 a year, the financial experts will tell you need 10 times that pay or 12
you
times that pay.
You need close to $1 million.
$500,000-$600,000. You need a lot more money than people have got. Okay, so let's understand that. So if we move in that direction, whosever retirement plan we're talking about, we're going to have poverty of lots. Half the people in the baby boomer generation are going to wind up having their retirement years end up in poverty.
In poverty.
Okay. So the first thing we have to do is go back and take a look at the plans we used to have in city government, in large corporations and so forth, and say, was this built on a life expectancy of 65 or 70? Because if you work for 30, 35 years and you either generated the benefits or put away money in your 401k, you could support yourself. But if you're going to live to 85 or 90, there's not enough money there. So one of the first things we have to do is see what's the financial assumption. And I think, you know, some of the trade unions, some of the municipal unions and so forth are going to have to acknowledge that the life expectancy of the plan as it was built is not adequate for how we're living today. So there's got to be an adjustment there. We got to stretch out the benefits, okay? And that may mean some reduction in what they're going to get over time, or they're going to have to wait for the benefits. But on the other hand, we're going to have to continue enforce it to pay for it. I mean, we're looking for free lunch here in America today. We don't want to pay high taxes. Yeah. And we don't want to pay for education. We don't want to pay for roads. We don't want to pay for anything. I want to keep it myself. On the other hand, I want all the benefits. We're looking for a free lunch society here, and that's not going to work. And it's interesting. If you look at other countries that are competing well in the world, take Germany, they pay their workers higher than Americans do, by the way. The median worker in Germany today for Daimler-Benz, for Airbus, for Bayer, for Siemens, the big companies, they get paid better dollar for dollar than American middle-class workers get paid. They have an export policy that works, that succeeds. Germany has an export surplus. They sell more to the world than they buy. We have an export deficit that's huge. We buy more than we sell. So there's something wrong there. They've kept 21% of their jobs in manufacturing. We have 9% of our jobs in manufacturing. So when you ask how you're going to deal with benefits like retirement, you have to go look and say, how is the economy working? How do we generate jobs so we have more working people to pay the benefit of the retirement of the people that are retiring? So it's not just that program. That's one of the problems. We look at it too narrowly. How do we generate growth in America? How do we generate jobs? And how do we boost the wages of the people at the bottom so they can afford to save?
All important questions you'll take on tomorrow night in your talk at Flagler College. And today, I believe, you're going to be meeting with students. Is that right?
Well, I'm going to meet with some students tomorrow as well. History, American policy, business, economics, and so on. I'm really interested in getting into dialogue because I think, you know, this is a generation that comes out of college facing really difficult job situations.
And,
They're living at home.
And a huge debt load, too.
And a huge debt load. $1 trillion of student debt we have. Now, we're talking about worrying about raising taxes and leaving a debt burden on the next generation. By not raising taxes in Florida or other states today, we're imposing a debt on the kids who are going to state colleges today. So we are, as adults, we're not paying the bill for the next generation. We're dumping it on them right now. So, I mean, that's not really fair. I think kids are interested in that. How do you deal with that? I'm very interested in the dialogue. I'm interested in the millennial generation is different. They've got different attitudes. They're more open about things. And they may want to get involved the same way the generation in the 60s got involved, 70s got involved. Maybe they may be more like them than like the baby boomers.
Well, they'll be privileged to hear you speak. And we're very excited to host you. Thank you for being with us.
Melissa, my pleasure.